The Suggs boys were already mounted. Little Eddie handed Jake his rein. "I guess that's the end of that romance," Dan Suggs said. "Darn, I just asked her name," Jake said. "I never knowed she was married." The Nestors were all grouped around the body. The girl still sat on the wagon seat. "Let's cross the river," Dan Suggs said. "It's that or hire you a lawyer. And I say, why waste the money?" "That store don't sell lawyers anyway," Roy Suggs remarked. Jake mounted, but he was reluctant to leave. It occurred to him that if he went back to the Nestors, he might bluff his way out of it. After all, it had been self-defense. Even dirt farmers from Missouri could understand that. The Nestors were looking their way, but none of them were offering to fight. If he turned and rode into the territory, he would be carrying two killings against his name. In neither case had he meant to kill, or even known the man he killed. It was just more bad luck. Noticing a pretty girl on a wagon seat was where it started in this case. But the law wouldn't look at it like that, of course. If he rode across the river with a hard bunch like the Suggses, he would be an outlaw, whereas if he stayed, the Nestors might try to hang him, or at least try to jail him in Fort Worth or Dallas. If that happened, he'd soon be on trial for one accident or another. It was a poor set of choices, it seemed to him, but when the Suggs brothers rode off, he followed, and in 15 minutes was across the Red River. Once he looked back and could still see the wagons grouped around the little store. He remembered the girl's last smile. Yet he had killed a man before he had even seen her smile. The Nestors made no pursuit. "Them pumpkin rollers," Dan Suggs said contemptuously. "If they was to follow, we'd thin 'em out in a hurry." Jake fell into a gloom. It seemed he could do nothing right. He hardly asked for more in life than a clean saloon to gamble in and a pretty whore to sleep with, that and a little whiskey to drink. He had no desire to be shooting people. Even during his years in the Rangers, he seldom actually drew aim at anyone, although he cheerfully threw off shots in the direction of the enemy. He certainly didn't consider himself a killer. In battle, Call and Gus were capable of killing 10 to his 1. And yet now Call and Gus were respectable cattlemen, looked up to everywhere they went, and he was riding with a gang of hardened outlaws who didn't care who they killed. Somehow he had slipped out of the respectable life. He had never been a churchgoer, but until recently he had had no reason to fear the law. The Suggs brothers kept plenty of whiskey on hand, and Jake began to avail himself of it. He stayed half drunk most of the time as they rode north. Even though he had killed a man in plain sight of them, the Suggses didn't treat him with any new respect. Of course, they didn't offer one another much respect either. Dan and Roy both poured scorn on little Eddie if he slipped up in his chores or made a remark they disagreed with. The only man of the company who escaped their scorn was Froglip. They seldom spoke to him, and he seldom spoke, but everyone knew he was there. They rode through the territory without incident, frequently seeing cattle herds on the move, but always swinging around them. Dan Suggs had an old pair of spyglasses he had brought back from the war, and once in a while he would stand up in his stirrups and look one of the cattle outfits over to see if they contained enemies of his, or any cowboys he recognized. Jake watched the herds, too, for he still had hope of escaping from the situation he was in. Rude as Call and Gus had treated him, they were still his compañeros. If he spotted the Hat Creek outfit, he had it in mind to sneak off and rejoin them. Even though he had made another mistake, the boys wouldn't know about it, and the news might never reach Montana. He would even cowboy if he had to. It beat taking his chances with the Suggses. He was careful not to give his feelings away, though. He never inquired about the herds. And if the subject of Call and McCrae came up, he made it plain that he harbored a grudge against them and would not be sorry to see them come to grief. When they got up into Kansas, they began to see the occasional settler, sod house Nestors mostly. Jake hardly thought any of them could have enough money to be worth the trouble of robbing, but the younger Suggs brothers were all for trying them. "I thought we was going to regulate the settlers," Roy said one night. "What are we waiting for?" "A Nester that's got something besides a milk cow and a pile of buffalo chips," Dan Suggs said. "I'm looking for a rich one." If one was rich, he wouldn't be living in a hole dug out of a hill up here in Kansas, Jake said. I slept in one of those soddies once. So much dirt leaked out of the roof during the night that I woke up darn near buried. That don't mean some of them couldn't have some gold, little Eddie said. I'd like to practice regulating a little so I'd have the hang of it when we do strike the rich ones. All we aim to let you do is watch anyway, Dan said. It don't take no practice to watch. I've shot a nester, little Eddie reminded him. Shot two. If they don't pay up, I might make it three. The object is to scare them out of their money, not shoot them, Dan said. You shoot too many, and pretty soon you've got the law after you. We want to get rich, not get hung. He's too young to know what he's talking about, Roy said. Well, I won't shoot them then. I'll just scare them, little Eddie said. No, that's Froglip's job, scaring them pumpkin eaters, Dan said. He'll scare them a sight worse than you will. The next day, Froglip got his chance. They saw a man plowing beside a team of big horses. A woman and a small boy were carrying buffalo chips in a wheelbarrow and piling them beside a low-sod house that was dug into a slope. Two milk cows grazed nearby. He can afford them big horses, Roy pointed out. Maybe he's got money. Dan had been about to ride past, and Jake hoped he would. He still hoped they'd hit Dodge before the Suggs boys did any regulating. He might get free of them in Dodge. Two accidents wouldn't necessarily brand him for life, but if he traveled much further with a gun outfit like the Suggses, he couldn't expect a peaceful old age, or any old age, probably. But Dan decided on a whim to go rob the farmer, if he had anything worth being robbed of. They usually hide their money in the chimney, he said. Either that or they bury it in the orchard, though I don't see no orchard. Froglip kept an extra pistol in his saddlebags. As they approached the farmer, he got it out and stuck it in his belt. The farmer was plowing a shallow furrow through the tough prairie grass. Seeing the rider's approach, he stopped. He was a middle-aged man with a curly black beard, thoroughly sweated from his work. His wife and son watched the Suggses approach. Their wheelbarrow was nearly full of buffalo chips. "Well, I guess you can expect a fine crop along about July, if the damn Texas cattle don't come along and eat it all up," Dan said. The man nodded in a friendly way, as if he agreed with the sentiment. "We're here to see you reap what you sow," Dan went on. "It'll cost you $40 gold, but we'll deal with the herds when they show up and your crops won't be disturbed." "No speaking English," the man said, still smiling and nodding in a friendly way. "Oh, hell, a damn German," Dan said. "I figured this was a waste of time. Round up the woman and the sprout, Frog. Maybe this old Dutchman married an American gal." Froglip loped over and drove the woman and the boy near the farmer. He rode so close to them that if they had fallen, his horse would have stepped on them. He had taken the pistol out of his belt, but he didn't need it. The woman and the boy were terrified, and the farmer, too. He put his arms around his wife and child, and they all stood there, crying. "Look at them blubber," little Eddie said. "I've never seen such cowards." "Will you shut your damn mouth," Dan said. "Why wouldn't they be scared? I would be in their place, but I'd like to get that woman hushed long enough to see if she can talk English." The woman either couldn't or wouldn't. She didn't utter a word in any language. She was tall and skinny, and she just stood there by her husband, crying. It was plain all three of them expected to be killed. Dan repeated his request for money, and only the boy looked as if he understood it. He stopped crying for a minute. "That's it, sonny. It's only cash we want," Dan said. "Tell your pa to pay us, and we'll help him guard his crops." Jake hardly expected a scared boy to believe that, but the boy did stop crying. He spoke to his father in the old tongue, and the man, whose face ran with tears, composed himself a little and jabbered at the boy. The boy turned and ran lickety-split for the sod house. "Go with him. See what you can find, boys, Dan said. Me and Jake can ride herd on the family, I guess. They don't look too violent. 10 minutes later, the boy came racing back, crying again, and Frog Lip and the two younger Suggses followed. They had an old leather wallet with them, which Roy Suggs threw to Dan. It had 2 small gold pieces in it. Why, this ain't but $4, Dan said. Did you look good? Yeah, we tore up the chimney and opened all the trunks, Roy said. That purse was under the pallet they sleep on. They don't have a darn thing worth taking besides that. $4 to see 'em through, Dan said. That won't help 'em much. We might as well take it. He took the 2 gold pieces and tossed the worn leather purse back at the man's feet. Let's go, he said. Jake was glad to see it come to no worse than that, but as they were riding away, Froglip turned and loped over to the milk cows. What's he aim to do, shoot the milk cows? Little Eddie asked, for Froglip had his pistol in his hand. I didn't ask him, and he didn't say, Dan replied. Froglip rode up beside the cows and fired a couple of shots into the air. When the cows started a lumbering run, he skillfully turned them up the slope and chased them onto the roof of the sod house. The sod on the roof had grass still on it and looked not unlike the prairie. The cows took a few steps onto the roof, and then their forequarters disappeared, as if they had fallen into a hole. Then their hindquarters disappeared, too. Froglip reined in his horse and watched as both cows fell through the roof of the sod house. A minute later, one came squeezing out the small door, and the other followed. Both cows trotted back to where they had been grazing. That frog, Dan said. I guess he just wanted to ventilate the house a little. All we got was $4, Little Eddie said. Well, it was your idea, Dan said. You wanted the practice, and you got it. He's mad because he didn't get to shoot nobody, Roy said. He thinks he's a shooter. Well, this is a gun outfit, ain't it? Little Eddie said. We ain't cowboys. So what are we then? Travelers, Dan said. Right now we're traveling to Kansas, looking for what we can find. Froglip rejoined them as silently as he had left. Despite himself, Jake could not conquer his fear of the man. Froglip had never said anything hostile to him, or even looked his way on the whole trip, and yet Jake felt a sort of apprehension whenever he rode close to the man. In all his travels in the West, he had met few men who gave off such a sense of danger. Even Indians didn't, although, of course, there had been few occasions when he had ridden close to an Indian. I wonder if them soddies will get that roof fixed before the next rain, Dan Suggs said. If they had had a little more cash, Frog might have left them alone. Froglip didn't comment.
Chapter 69.
It took July only a day or two to determine that Elmira was not in Dodge City. The town was a shock to him, for almost every woman in it seemed to be a whore, and almost every business a saloon. He kept trying to tell himself he shouldn't be surprised, for he had heard for years that Kansas towns were wild. In Missouri, where he had gone to testify at the trial, there was much talk of Kansas. People in Missouri seemed to consider that they had gotten rid of all their riffraff to the cow towns. July quickly concluded that they were right. There might be rough elements in Missouri, but what struck him in Kansas was the absence of any elements that weren't rough. Of course, there were a few stores and a livery stable or two in Dodge, even a hotel of sorts, though the whores were in and out of the hotel so much that it seemed more like a whorehouse. Gamblers were thick in the saloons, and he had never seen a place where as many people went armed. The first thing July did was buy a decent horse. He went to the post office, for he felt he owed Fort Smith an explanation as to why he had not come back. For some reason, he felt a surge of optimism as he walked down the street to the post office. Now that he had survived the plains, it seemed possible that he could find Ellie after all. He had lost all interest in catching Jake Spoon. He just wanted to find his wife and go home. If Peach didn't like it, and she wouldn't, she would just have to lump it. If Ellie wasn't in Dodge, she would probably be in Abilene. He would soon catch up to her. But to his surprise, the minute he stepped inside the door of the post office, his optimism gave way in a flash to bitter depression. In trying to think of what he would say in his letter, he remembered all that had happened. Roscoe was dead. Joe was dead. The girl was dead. And Ellie not found. Maybe she too was dead. All he had to report was death and failure. At the thought of poor Roscoe, gutted and left under a little pile of rocks on the prairie, his eyes filled with tears, and he had to turn and walk back out the door to keep from embarrassing himself. He walked along the dusty street for a few minutes, wiping the tears out of his eyes with a shirt sleeve. One or two men observed him curiously. It was obvious that he was upset, but no one said anything to him. He remembered walking into the post office in Fort Worth and getting the letter that told him about Ellie. Since then, it had all been puzzlement and pain. He felt that in most ways it would have been better if he had died on the plains with the rest of them. He was tired of wandering and looking. But he hadn't died, and eventually he turned and went back into the post office, which was empty except for an elderly clerk with a white mustache. "Well, you're back," the clerk said. "That was you a while ago, wasn't it?" "That was me," July admitted. He bought an envelope, a stamp, and a couple of sheets of writing paper, and the clerk, who seemed kindly, loaned him a pencil to write with. "You can write it here at the window," the clerk said. "We're not doing much business today." July started, and then, to his embarrassment, began to cry again. His memories were too sad, his hopes too thin. To have to say things on paper seemed a terrible task, for it stirred the memories. "I guess somebody died and you've got to write their folks. Is that it?" the clerk said. "Yes," July said. "Only two of them didn't have no folks." He vaguely remembered that Roscoe had a few brothers, but none of them lived around Fort Smith or had been heard of in years. He wiped his eyes on his shirt sleeve again, reflecting that he had cried more in the last few weeks than he had his whole life up to that point. After standing there, staring at the paper for a few minutes, he finally wrote a brief letter addressed to Peach. "Dear Peach, Roscoe Brown was killed by a bad outlaw. So was Joe. A girl named Janie was also killed. I don't know much about her. Roscoe said he met her in the woods. I don't know when I'll be back. The folks can hire another sheriff if they want to. Somebody has to look after the town. Your brother-in-law, July Johnson." He had already pretty well convinced himself that Elmira was not in Dodge City, for he had been in every public place in town and had not seen her. But since the old clerk seemed kindly, he thought he might as well ask. Maybe she had come in to mail a letter at some point. "I'm looking for a woman named Elmira," he said. "She's got brown hair, and she ain't very big." "Ellie?" the clerk said. "Well, I ain't seen Ellie in 2 or 3 years. Seems like I heard she moved to Abilene." "That's her," July said, encouraged again all of a sudden. Ellie had been living in Abilene before she moved to St. Joe, where he had found her. "I thought she might have come back," he added. "No, I ain't seen her," the clerk said. "But you might ask Jenny, up at the third saloon. She and Elmira used to be thick once. I think they even married the same man, if you want to call it married." "Oh, Mr. Boot?" July asked. "Yes, D. Boot, the scoundrel," the clerk said. "How could he be married to the two of them?" July asked, not sure he wanted the information, but unable to stop talking to a man who could tell him something about Ellie. "Why, D. Boot would bed down with a possum if the possum was female. He was a cutter with the ladies." "Didn't he die of smallpox?" July asked. The clerk shook his head. "Not as far as I know," he said. "He's up in Ogallala or Deadwood or somewhere, where there's lots of whores and not too much law. I imagine he's got 5 or 6 whores in a string right now." Of course he could have died, but he's my nephew, and I ain't heard no news to that effect. Thank you for the loan of the pencil, July said. He turned and walked out. He went straight to the livery stable and got his new horse, whose name was Pete. If Elmira wasn't in Dodge, she might be in Abilene, so he might as well start. But he didn't start. He rode halfway out of town and then went back to the third saloon from the post office and inquired about the woman named Jenny. They said she had moved to another bar up the street. A cowboy was even kind enough to point out the bar. A herd had been sold that morning and was being loaded onto boxcars. July rode over and watched the work for a while, slow work and made slower by the cattle's long horns, which kept getting tangled with one another as the cattle were being forced up the narrow loading chute. The cowboys yelled and popped their quirts, and the horses behaved expertly, but despite that it seemed to take a long time to fill a boxcar. Still, July liked the look of the cowboys. He always had. Even when they got a little rowdy, as they sometimes did in Fort Smith, they were young and friendly and seemed not to have a care in the world. They rode as if they were grown to their horses. Their teamwork when the cattle misbehaved and tried to break out was interesting to see. He saw a cowboy rope a running steer by the horns and then cleverly trip it so that the steer fell heavily. When the animal rose, it showed no more fight and was soon loaded. After watching the loading for a while, he went back to the saloon where the woman named Jenny was said to work. He inquired for her at the bar, and the bartender, a skinny runt, said she was busy and asked if he wanted a whiskey. July seldom drank whiskey, but he said yes, to be courteous mainly. If he was taking up space in a bar, he ought to pay for it, he figured. So he took the whiskey and sipped it until it was gone, and then took another. Soon he was feeling heavy, as if it would be difficult to walk fast if he had to, but in fact he didn't have to. Women came and went in the saloon, but the bartender, who poured the whiskies, kept assuring him that Jenny would be down any minute. July kept drinking. It seemed to him that he was taking on weight in a hurry. He felt that just getting out of his chair would be more than he could do. He felt so heavy. The bartender kept bringing whiskies, and it seemed to July that he must be running up quite a bill. But it didn't worry him. Occasionally, a cowboy would pass by, his spurs jingling. Some of them gave July a look, but none of them spoke to him. It was comfortable to sit in the saloon. As sheriff, he had usually avoided them unless he had business in one. It had always puzzled him how some men could spend their days just sitting in a saloon, drinking, but now it was beginning to seem less puzzling. It was restful, and the heavy feeling that came with the drinking was a relief to him, in a way. For the last few weeks he had been struggling to do things which were beyond his power. He knew he was supposed to keep trying, even if he wasn't succeeding, but it was pleasant not to try for a little while. Then he looked up and saw a woman standing by the table. She was skinny, like Elmira, and had stringy black hair. "Let's get going, cowboy," she said. "You can't do nothing sitting there." "Get going where?" he asked, taken by surprise. No one had ever called him cowboy before, but it was a natural mistake. He had taken off his sheriff's star for a few days, a precaution he often took in a strange town. "I'm Jenny," she said. "Sam said you were looking for me, or have I got the wrong cowboy?" "Oh," July said, embarrassed. He had even forgotten he was waiting for someone named Jenny. "We could get going, even if you ain't the right cowboy," Jenny said. "If you can afford that much whiskey, you can afford me. You could even buy me a drink if you felt polite." July had never in his life bought a woman a drink, or even sat with a woman who liked a drink. Any other time, such an invitation would have shocked him. But in this case, it just made him feel that his manners weren't all they should be. Jenny had huge brown eyes, too large for her thin face. She was looking at him impatiently. "Yes, have a drink," he said. "I'm running up a bill." Jenny sat down and waved at the bartender, who immediately appeared with a bottle. "This one's drinking like a fish," he said cheerfully. "I guess it's been a long, dry trail." July suddenly remembered why he was waiting to see the girl named Jenny. "Did you know Ellie?" he asked. I heard you note her. It was Jenny's turn to be surprised. Elmira had been her best friend for 3 years, and she hardly expected a drunken young cowboy to mention her name.
You mean Ellie Tim? She asked.
Yes, July said. That's the Ellie. I was hoping you had news of her. I don't know where she is.
Well, she moved to Missouri, Jenny said. Then we heard she married a sheriff from Arkansas, but I didn't put no stock in that kind of rumor. I can't imagine Ellie staying married to no sheriff.
She didn't, July said. She run off while I was chasing Jake Spoon, and I got 3 people killed since I started looking for her.
Jenny looked at the young man more closely. She had noticed right off that he was drunk, but drunks were an everyday sight, and she had not looked close. The man seemed very young, which is why she had taken him for a cowboy. They were mostly just boys, but this man didn't have the look of a cowboy once she looked close. He had a solemn face and sad eyes, the saddest she had looked into for a while. On the basis of the eyes, he was an unlikely man for Ellie to have married. Ellie liked her laughs, but then people often did unlikely things.
"Are you a sheriff?" she asked, sipping the whiskey Sam had poured.
"I was," July said.
"I'm most likely going to have to give it up."
"Why do that?" Jenny asked.
"I ain't a good fighter," July said. "I can crack a drunk on the head and get him to jail, but I ain't really a good fighter." When we rode into that camp, the man with me killed 6 or 7 men, and I never killed one. I went off and I left Roscoe and the others, and they got killed before I could get back. It was only Jake Spoon I went to catch, but I made a mess of it. I don't want to be sheriff now.
He had not expected such words to rush out. He had suddenly lost control of his speech somehow. Jenny had not expected it either. She sipped her whiskey and watched him.
"They say Ellie left on a whiskey boat," July said. "I don't know why she would have done that, but that's what they say. Roscoe thought a bear might have got her, but they didn't see no tracks."
"What's your name?" Jenny asked.
"July Johnson," he said, glad that she was no longer looking at him quite so impatiently.
"Sounds like Ellie to me," Jenny said. "When Ellie gets enough of a place, she jumps in the first wagon and goes. I remember when she went to Abilene. I didn't have no idea she was even thinking of leaving. And then, before it was even time to go to work, she had paid some mule skinners to take her, and she was gone."
"I gotta find her," July said simply.
"You come to the wrong town, mister," Jenny said. "She ain't in Dodge."
"Well, then I'll have to keep looking," July said.
He thought of the empty plains, which it seemed to him he had been lucky to get across. There seemed only the smallest chance that Ellie would have been so lucky.
"I fear she's dead," he said.
"She's hunting Dee, I'd say," Jenny said. "Did you know Dee?"
"Oh, I know," July said. "I was told he died of smallpox."
Jenny chuckled. "Dee ain't dead," she said. "He's an old Galala. There's a gambler sitting right over there who seen him not 2 months ago."
"Where?" July asked. And Jenny pointed to a pudgy man in a white shirt and a black coat who sat alone at a table, shuffling cards.
"That's Webster Witter," Jenny said. "He keeps up with Dee Boot. I used to, but I quit."
"Why?" July asked. He sensed that it was a rather loose-tongued question, but the fact was his tongue was out of control and behaving ever more loosely.
"It was like trying to keep up with a tumbleweed," Jenny said. "Dee wears out one town, and then he's off to another. I ain't that way. I like to settle in. I've been here in Dodge for 5 years already, and I guess this is where I'll stay."
"I don't know why she married me," July said. "I ain't got any idea about it."
Jenny looked at him for a bit.
"Do you always drink like this?" she asked.
"No,
I seldom drink, July said. Though I do like a toddy in the winter. Jenny looked at him a while. You ought to stop worrying about L.A., mister, she said. No man's ever been able to stop L.A. for long, not even D. She married me, July said. He felt he had to insist on that point. Well, I married D once myself, Jenny said. I just did it because he was good-looking. That and the fact that I was mad at somebody else. Ellie and me are a lot alike, she added. July just looked at her sadly. Jenny sighed. She had not expected to encounter such misery in the middle of the afternoon. You're right good-looking, she said. I expect that explains it. If I were you, I'd start getting over it. I got to find her, July said. I got to tell her about little Joe. He got killed on the Canadian. She oughtn't have had him, Jenny said. I told her not to. I wouldn't have one for anything. I've had offers to. July drank two more whiskeys, but had little more to say. Well, the bar is getting rich, but I ain't, Jenny said. Don't you want a little fun? To take your mind off it. It seemed to July that he was not so much sitting in the chair as floating in it. The world seemed kind of watery to him, but it was all right because he was easily able to float. Jenny giggled, looking at him. You're so drunk, Mr. Johnson, she said. Let's go have a little fun. I always like stealing Ellie's boys, and here I've got a chance to steal her husband. The way she giggled made July feel happy suddenly. He had not heard a woman giggle in a long time. Ellie never giggled. So he got up and followed Jenny up the stairs, walking carefully so as not to embarrass himself. He got upstairs all right, but before he could get to Jenny's room, he began to feel wrong. His stomach began to float higher than he was. It began to float right out of his mouth. Jenny had kept a close eye on him, and she quickly guided him to the outside stairs. July knelt down on the little landing and vomited over the edge. The next thing he knew, he was lying flat on the landing, still vomiting. From time to time, he quit vomiting and just lay there. But then he would start again, his body heaving upward like a bucking horse. He held to the rail of the landing with one hand so he wouldn't accidentally heave himself over. It was a bright day, the Kansas sun beating down, but July felt like he was in darkness. Cowboys rode up and down the street below him. Once in a while, one would hear him vomiting and look up and laugh. Wagons went by, and the drivers didn't even look up. Once, while he was resting, two cowboys stopped and looked at him. I guess we ought to rope him and drag him to the graveyard, one said. He looks dead to me. Hell, I wish all I had to do was lay on them stairs and vomit, the other cowboy said. Beats loading them longhorns. July lay face down for a long time. The heaves finally diminished, but from time to time he raised his head and spat over the edge to clear his throat. It was nearly sundown before he felt like sitting up, and then it was only to sit with his back against the building. He was high enough that he could see over the main street and the cattle pens and west to where the sun was setting, far off on the plain. It was setting behind a large herd of cattle being held a mile or two from town. There were thousands of cattle, but only a few cowboys holding them. He could see the other cowboys racing for town. The dust their running horses kicked up was turned golden by the sun. No doubt they were just off the trail and couldn't wait for a taste of Dodge. The very taste he had just vomited up. The last sunlight filtered through the settling dust behind the cowboys' horses. July sat where he was until the afterglow was just a pale line on the western horizon. The white moon shone on the railroad ties that snaked out of town to the east. He felt too weak to stand up, and he sat listening to the sounds of laughter that came from the saloon behind him. When he finally stood up, he was indecisive. He didn't know if he should go in and thank Jenny or just slip away and continue the search for Elmira. He had an urge to just ride on out into the dark country. He didn't feel right in the town anymore. The crowds of happy cowboys just made him feel more lonesome somehow.
On the plains, with nobody in sight, he wasn't reminded so often of how cut off he felt. He decided, though, that politeness required him to at least say goodbye to Jenny. As he stepped back in the door, a cowboy came out of a room, looking cheerful, and went clumping down the stairs. A moment later, Jenny came out, too. She didn't notice July standing there. To his astonishment, she stopped and lifted her skirts so that he could see her thin legs and more. There was a smear of something on one thigh, and she hastily wet her fingers with a little spit and wiped it off. Just then she noticed July, who wished he had not bothered to come through the door. He had never seen a woman do such an intimate thing, and the shock was so strong he thought his stomach might float up again. When Jenny saw him, she was not very embarrassed. She giggled again and lowered her skirts. "Well, you got a free look, but I won't count it," she said. "I guess you didn't die." "No," July said. Jenny looked closely at him as if to make sure he was all right. She had a poor complexion, but he liked her frank brown eyes. "What about the fun?" she said. "You lost out this afternoon." "Oh," July said. "I'm not much fun." "I guess you wouldn't be after vomiting up your stomach," Jenny said. "I can't wait, though, mister. Three herds came in today, and there's a line of cowboys waiting to fall in love with me." She looked down the stairs. The noise from the saloon was loud. "It's what I did with Ellie," July said. Meeting her friend Jenny had made his life clearer to him suddenly. He was as simple as the cowboys. He had fallen in love with a whore. Jenny looked at him a moment. She had come out of her room briskly, prepared for more business, but something in July's eyes slowed her down. She had never seen eyes with so much sadness in them. To look at him made her heart drop a little. "Ellie was tired of this business," she said. "It was the buffalo hunters that made her decide to quit. I guess you just come along at the right time." "Yes," July said. They were silent, looking at one another. Jenny reluctant to go down into the well of noise, July not ready to go out the door and head for the livery stable. "Don't you want to quit?" he asked. "Why, are you going to fall in love with me too?" Jenny asked, in her frank way. July knew he could if he wasn't careful. He was so lonely, and he didn't have much control. "Don't you want to quit?" he asked again. Jenny shook her head. "I like to see the boys coming in," she said. "People are always coming in here in Dodge. The cowboys are nicer than the buffalo hunters, but even the buffalo hunters was people." She thought a moment. "I couldn't sit around in a house all day," she said. "If someone was ever to marry me, I expect I'd run off, too. The time I get blue is the winter. There ain't no people coming in." July thought of Ellie, sitting in the cabin loft all day, dangling her legs. No people came in at all except him and Joe, and Roscoe once in a while when they caught a catfish. Hearing Jenny talk put his life with Ellie in a very different light. "You ought to go back home," Jenny said. "Even if you catch her, it won't do no good." July feared it wouldn't, but he didn't want to go back. He just stood there. Something in his manner made Jenny suddenly impatient. "I've got to go," she said. "If you ever do find Ellie, tell her I still got that blue dress she gave me. If she wants it back, she'll have to write." July nodded. Jenny gave him a final look, half pitying, half exasperated, and hurried down the stairs. July felt sad when she left. He had the feeling that an opportunity had been missed, though he didn't know what kind of opportunity. The streets were full of cowboys going from one saloon to the next. There were horses tied to every hitch rail. He went to the livery stable and saddled his new horse. The old man who ran the stable was sitting with his back against a barrel of horseshoe nails, drinking now and then from a jug he had between his legs. July paid him, but the old man didn't stand up. "Which outfit are you with?" the old man asked. "I'm with myself," July said. "Oh," the man said. "Small outfit. This is a funny time of night to be starting out, ain't it?" "I guess it is," July said, but he started anyway.
Chapter 70.
Once they got west, beyond the line of the grasshopper plague, the herd found good grass. The sky stayed clear for nearly 2 weeks, and the drive went the smoothest it had gone. The cattle settled down and moved north toward the Arkansas without stampedes or other incidents, except for one, a freak accident that cost Newt his favorite horse, Mouse. Newt wasn't even riding Mouse when the accident occurred. He had traded mounts for the day with Ben Rainey. The day's work was over, and Ben had ridden into the herd with Call's permission to cut out a beef for the cook. He rode up to a little brindled cow, meaning to take her yearling calf. And while he was easing the calf away from her, the cow turned mean suddenly and hooked Mouse right back of the girth. She was a small cow with unusually sharp horns, and her thrust was so violent that Mouse's hindquarters were lifted off the ground. Ben Rainey was thrown and had to scramble to keep from being hooked himself. Soupy Jones saw it happen. He loped in and soon turned the mad cow, but the damage was done. Mouse was spurting blood like a fountain from his abdomen. "Get Dietz," Soupy said. Dietz was the best horse doctor in the outfit, though Pocampo was also good. Both men came over to look at the wound, and both shook their heads. Newt, on the other side of the herd, saw people waving at him and loped over. When he saw Mouse gushing blood, he felt faint from the shock. "I don't know what went wrong with her," Ben Rainey said, feeling guilty. "I wasn't doing nothing to her. She just hooked the horse. Next thing I knew, she was after me. She has them little sharp, twisty horns." Mouse's hind legs were quivering. "Well, you better put him down," Call said, looking at Newt. "He's finished." Newt was about to take the reins when Dish Boget intervened. "Oh, now, Captain," he said quietly, "a feller oughtn't to have to shoot his own horse when there's others around that can do it as well." And without a word, he led the bleeding horse 100 yards away and shot him. He came back carrying the saddle. Newt was very grateful. He knew he would have had a hard time shooting Mouse. "I wish now we'd never traded," Ben Rainey said. "I never thought anything would happen." That night there was much discussion of the dangers of handling cattle. Everyone agreed there were dangers, but no one had ever heard of a small cow hooking a horse under the girth before and killing it. Newt traded shifts with the Irishman and then traded again with his replacement 4 hours later. He wanted to be in the dark, where people couldn't see him cry. Mouse had never behaved like other horses, and now he had even found a unique way to die. Newt had had him for 8 years and felt his loss so keenly that for the first time on the drive he wished it wouldn't get light so soon. But the sun came up beautifully, and he knew he would have to go into breakfast. He rubbed the tear streaks off his face as best he could and was about to head for the wagon when he saw Mr. Gus standing outside his little tent waving at him. Newt rode over. As he passed the open flap of the tent, he saw Lorena sitting on a pallet just inside. Her hair was loose around her shoulders, and she looked very beautiful. Augustus had made a fire of buffalo chips and was complaining about it. "Darn, I hate to cook with shit," he said. "I hear you lost your pony." "Yes." Ben was riding him. "It wasn't his fault, though," Newt said. "Get down and drink a cup of coffee. Cut the grief," Augustus said. As he was drinking the coffee, Lorena came out of the tent. To Newt's surprise, she smiled at him. She didn't say anything, but she smiled. It was such a joy that he immediately started feeling better. All the way from Texas, he had been worrying secretly that Lorena would blame him for her kidnap. After all, he had been supposed to watch her the night she got taken. But she obviously bore him no grudge. She stood in front of the tent, looking at the beautiful morning. "I've got so I like this looking far," she said. Augustus handed her a cup of coffee, and she held it in both hands, the smoke drifting in front of her face. Newt was sure he had never seen anyone as beautiful as her. That he was getting to share breakfast with her was like a miracle. Dish or any of the other boys would give their spurs and saddles to be doing what he was doing. She sat down in front of the tent and blew on her coffee until it was cool enough to drink. Newt drank his and felt a lot better. Poor Mouse was lost, but it was a wonderful day, and he was enjoying the rare privilege of having breakfast with Mr. Gus and Lorena. Across the plain, they could see the herd strung out to the north. The wagon and the remuda were a mile behind them. Pocampo, a tiny dot on the plain, walked well behind the wagon.
"That old cook is a sight," Augusta said. "I guess he plans to walk all the way to Canada."
"He likes to watch the grass," Newt explained. "He's always finding stuff. He'll cook most anything he picks up." "Does he cook grass?" Lorena asked, interested. She had never seen Pocampo close up, but was intrigued by the sight of the tiny figure walking day after day across the great plain.
"No, but he cooks things like grasshoppers once in a while," Newt said.
Lorena laughed, a delightful sound to Newt. As she blew on her coffee, she looked at Gus. She had spent many hours looking at him since he had rescued her. It was comfortable traveling with him, for he never got angry or scolded her, as other men had. In the weeks when she trembled and cried, he had expressed no impatience and made no demands. She had become so used to him that she had begun to hope the trip would last longer. It had become simple and even pleasant for her. No one bothered her at all, and it was nice to ride along in the early summer sun, looking at the miles and miles of waving grass. Gus talked and talked. Some of what he said was interesting, and some of it wasn't, but it was reassuring that he liked to talk to her. It was enough of a life, and better than any she had had before. But she could not forget the other woman Gus had mentioned. The other woman was the one thing he didn't talk about. She didn't ask, of course, but she couldn't forget either. She dreaded the day when they would come to the town where the other woman lived. For then the simple life might end. It wouldn't if she could help it, though. She meant to fight for it. She had decided to tell Gus that she would marry him before they got to the town. Never before had she given any thought to marrying a man. It had not seemed a likely thing. She had had enough of the kind of men who came into the saloons. Some of them wanted to marry her, of course, young cowboys mostly, but she didn't take that seriously. Gus was different. He had never said he wanted to marry her, but he was handier than most at complimenting her on her beauty. He complimented her still, almost every day, telling her she was the most beautiful woman on the plains. They got along well. They didn't quarrel. To her, it all said that he might want to marry her when they stopped. She was glad he had waved the boy over for breakfast. The boy was harmless, even rather sweet and likable. If she was friendly to the boy, it might make Gus think better of her as a wife-to-be. Though he had still not approached her, she felt him stirring when they slept close at night, and she meant to see that he did approach her before they got to Ogallala. She meant to do what she could to make him forget the other woman. When Newt rode back to the herd, he practically floated over the ground, he felt so happy. The death of Mouse was forgotten in the pleasure of remembering Lorena. She had smiled at him as he was mounting to leave. It was not lost on the cowboys that Newt had secured a rare invitation. As he loped back to the drags, many heads were turned his way, but the drive had started, and no one got much of a chance to question him until that evening, when they were all getting their grub. Dish, the friend who had relieved him of the burden of killing his own horse, was the most curious. "Did you get to see Lori?" Dish asked point blank. He still felt such love for Lori that even speaking her name caused him to feel weak sometimes. "I seen her. She was drinking coffee," Newt said.
"Yes, she always took coffee in the morning," Lippy said,
demonstrating a familiarity with Lorena's habits that offended Dish at once.
"Yes, I'm sure you spied on her every opportunity you got," he said hotly. "It didn't take no spying. She took it right in the saloon," Lippy said. "It was watch her go blind."
He was aware, as all the hands were, that Dish was mighty in love. But Dish was not the first cowboy to fall in love with a whore, and Lippy didn't feel he had to make too many concessions to the situation. "Dish don't allow low types like us the right to even look at the girl," Jasper remarked. He had met with nothing but rejection at the hands of Lorena, and was still bitter about it. "I bet Newt got a good look," Soupy said. "Newt's getting to an age to have an eye for the damsels." Newt kept silent, embarrassed. He would have liked to brag a little about his visit, perhaps even repeat one of the remarks Lorena had made, but he was aware that he couldn't do so without causing Dish Boget to feel bad that it wasn't him who had got the visit. "Is Lori still pretty, or has all the traveling ruined her looks?" Needle Nelson asked. "As if it could," Dish said angrily. "She's real pretty still," Newt said. "Mr. Gus did most of the talking." "Oh, Gus always does the most of it," P.I. said. "If they'd just pitched their tent a little closer, we could all hear it. Gus has a loud voice." "I wouldn't care to listen," Dish said. It rankled him continually that Gus had all of Lorena's company day after day. "I've never seen such a jealous bug as you are, Dish," Jasper said. Call had eaten quickly and left with Dietz. The Arkansas was only a few miles away, and he wanted to have a look at the crossing. They loped up to the river through the long prairie dusk and sat on the river bank a while. Even in the moonlight, they could see that the current was strong. "I've always heard the Arkansas was swift," Call said. "Did you try it?" "Oh, yes," Dietz said. "Took me down a ways." "It comes out of the same mountains as the Rio Grande," Call said. "Just a different side." "Reckon we'll ever get back, Captain?" Dietz asked. He had not planned to ask, but at mention of the Rio Grande, he felt a sudden homesickness. He had been back and forth across the Rio Grande for so many years that it made him sad to think that he might never see it again. The Rio Grande was shallow and warm and no trouble to cross, whereas the farther north they went, the colder and swifter the rivers became. Call was surprised by the question. "Why, some of the boys will be going back, I guess," he said. "I doubt that I'll return myself," he added, and hoped that Dietz wouldn't want to go either. He relied on Dietz too much. None of the other hands had his judgment. Dietz said no more about it, but his heart was heavy with a longing for Texas. Call looked up the river towards Colorado. "That darn bandit's up there somewhere," he said. "I wish Gus had got him." Dietz could tell by the grim way the captain was looking toward the mountains that he wished he could go after the man. Pursuit was what he and the captain did best, and now he was wishing he could pursue Blue Duck. Thinking to turn the captain's mind from the outlaw, Dietz mentioned something that he had considered keeping to himself. It was something he had noticed the day before while scouting to the east a few miles. "Wouldn't be surprised if Mr. Jake is around," he said. "Jake?" Carl asked. "Why would he be around?" "Might not be him, but his horse is around," Dietz said. "I crossed the track yesterday. It was that pacing horse he come home on." "I'll swear," Call said. "Are you sure about the horse?" "Oh, yes," Dietz said. "I know the track. 4 other horses with him. I guess Mr. Jake could have sold the horse." "I doubt he would," Call said. "Jake likes a pacer." He thought the information over as they trotted back toward the herd. He had meant it when he told Gus he wanted no more to do with Jake Spoon. Jake had only come back to Lonesome Dove to use them for support, and no doubt he would try to again if he got in trouble. This time it would probably be worse trouble, too. Once a man like Jake, who had got by on Dash and little else all his life, started sliding, he might slide faster and faster. "Oh, well," Call said. "We ain't far from Dodge. He may just be looking for a summer of gambling. Keep your eye out, though," he added. "If you strike his track again, you let me know." Dietz went on back to camp, but but Call stopped a mile away and staked his mare. He considered riding over to see Gus and passing on the news, but decided it could wait until morning. News of Jake might disturb the girl. If he was right, and Jake was just headed for Dodge, there was nothing to worry about. He sat up much of the night, listening to the Irishman sing to the cattle. As he was listening, a skunk walked between him and the mare. It nosed along, stopping now and then to scratch at the dirt. Call sat still, and the skunk soon went on its way. The hell bitch paid it no mind. She went on quietly grazing.
Chapter 71.
I'll be glad to get to Dodge, Jake said. I'd like a bath and a whore, and a good barber to shave me. There's a barber there named Sandy that I fancy, if nobody ain't shot him.
You'll know tomorrow, I guess, Dan Suggs said.
I've never liked barbers myself.
Dan don't even like whores, Roy Suggs said. Dan's hard to please.
Jake was cheered by the thought that Dodge was so close. He was tired of the empty prairie and the sullen Suggses, and was looking forward to jolly company and some good card games. He had every intention of wiggling loose from the Suggses and Dodge. Gambling might be his ticket. He could win a lot of money and tell them he'd had enough of the roving life. They didn't own him, after all. It was a sunny day, and Jake rode along happily. Sometimes he got a lucky feeling, a feeling that he was meant for riches and beautiful women and that nothing could keep him down for long. The lucky feeling came to him as he rode, and the main part of it was his sense that he was about to get free of the Suggs brothers. They were hard men, and he had made a bad choice in riding with them, but nothing very terrible had come of it, and they were almost to Dodge. It seemed to him that he had slid back into bad luck in Arkansas the day he accidentally shot the dentist, and now he was about to slide out of it in Kansas and resume the kind of enjoyable life he felt he deserved. Froglip was riding just in front of him, and he felt how nice it would be not to have to consort with such a man again. Froglip rode along silently, as he had the whole trip, but there was a menace in his silence, and Jake was ready for lighter company, a whore particularly. There were sure to be plenty of them in Dodge. In the afternoon, though, Dan Suggs, the man who was hard to please, saw something he liked, a herd of about 25 horses being driven south by 3 men. He rode over to a ridge and inspected the horses through his spyglasses. When he came back, he had a pleased look on his face. At the sight of it, Jake immediately lost his lucky feeling.
"It's old Will Barger," Dan said. "He's just got 2 hands with him."
"Well, I've heard of him," Jake said. "We returned some of his horses to him out of Mexico. Pedro Flores had them. I never met Will Barger myself."
"I've met him, the son of a bitch," Dan said. "I rode for him once."
"Where's he going with them horses? Back to Texas?" Roy asked.
"He's probably sold his lead herd in Dodge and has got another bunch or two headed for Denver. He's taking his boys some fresh mounts."
Will Barger and his horses were soon out of sight, but Dan Suggs made no move to resume the trip to Dodge.
"I guess Dan's feeling bloody," Roy said, observing his brother.
"I thought Will Barger was rough," little Eddie said.
"He is, but so am I," Dan Suggs said. "I never liked the man. I see no reason why we shouldn't have them horses."
Roy Suggs was not greatly pleased by his brother's behavior.
"Have 'em and do what with 'em?" he asked. "We can't sell 'em in Dodge if Will Barger's just been there."
"Dodge ain't the only town in Kansas," Dan said. "We can sell 'em in Abilene." With no further discussion, he turned and rode southwest at a slow trot. His brothers followed. Jake sat for a moment, his lucky feeling gone and a sense of dread in his place. He thought maybe the Suggs brothers would forget him, and he could ride on to Dodge, but then he saw Froglip looking at him. The black man was impassive.
"You coming?" he asked. The first time on the whole trip that he had spoken to Jake directly.
There was an insolence in his voice that caused Jake to flare up for a moment despite himself. I guess if you watch, you'll find out, Jake said, bitter that the man would address him so. Froglip just looked at him, neither smiling nor frowning.